stories don't define you. How you tell them will.
Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief storymaker at Elkins Consulting. In my work with coaching clients, I guide people to improve their communication using storytelling as the foundation of our work together. What I've realized over years of coaching and podcasting is that the majority of people don't realize the impact of the stories they share on their internal messages and on the people they're sharing them with. What really lights me up is guiding executives in uncovering the stories in their lives that are meaningful. The stories that, when shared with the right audience in the right way, connect, inspire, and motivate. Here's what a former client had to say about our work together. As a leader of leaders, I struggle with how and when to use my stories to emphasize the points my audience is looking for. It's a delicate balance between sounding like I'm bragging and delivering a message that needs to be heard. Sarah's approach to storytelling clears that obstacle so that you can deliver a clear and concise message using your stories to emphasize your points. It's truly amazing when it all comes together. Greg McDonough, Blackburn Capital Advisors, and president of the Entrepreneurs Organization of Washington, D.C. Visit ElkinsConsulting.com to learn more about working with me. What a pleasure today. I get to have Bob Berg on the Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, Bob.
Hey, Sarah. Honor is mine. So great to be with you.
Well, it's funny how we met, and this is not that unusual given our circle of friends and the people that we seem to invite into our lives somehow or other. It was really Larry Boyer that first told me about you.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
And he is. He's terrific. And he told me how he met you many years ago after writing an article about The Go-Giver, your book that I just recently read. And then my friend Aaron Scogan sent me a copy of the book, and I reached out to you. And I have to say, I wasn't surprised that you said yes. I was very pleased because it means that you're practicing what you preach.
No, oh, thank you.
Yes. Well, not everybody walks the walk. They talk a good game about being a giver, but when it comes down to it, that's not really their first instinct. So I appreciated that. So usually as I start out these podcast interviews, the first thing I like to ask my guests is to share something about themselves that most people might not know. It's not on your resume or your LinkedIn profile. And I ask that so that our listeners have some context for who you are outside of what people know about you. So what do you think? Do you have something to share?
I guess that I'm very, very much an introvert to the point of almost being a hermit when I don't have to be out of the house.
Wow. I guess that would probably surprise people since you do a lot of public speaking, right?
Yeah.
So that actually is a great lead-in because I think a lot of people are misunderstood in that way because their actions and the perceptions of people around them is different from who they really are, which is common, I guess. But a lot of people don't believe that they can be good at sales or public speaking or whatever they want to do, because they think that they're too introverted. So right. I'm curious, do you have a story about how you realized that you were going to be good at this despite your introverted tendencies?
I don't think that one is good at sales despite their introverted tendencies. I don't think it really matters. There's a misconception or a misperception about sales that was, to me highlighted when I was standing in line at a Dunkin' Donuts, restaurant, where there was a young kid who was kind of gabbing away and somebody in line said to another person, well, at least he'll be a good salesperson one day. And the premise was that because he's a gabber, a talker, that he's going to be good in sales, when actually the best salespeople are listeners. And you know that exactly. They're not talkers. So could that young man grow up to be a great salesperson? Could, but he'll have to get rid of his tendencies to be talking all the time.
Completely agree.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, a story regarding being introverted in a salesperson, nah, I don't think that has anything to do with it either way.
Mm-hmm. So when you, do you remember the first time you kind of got on a stage and started speaking?
Yeah, I really do. Well, what happened was I started out as a broadcaster, actually, first in radio doing sports and then on television doing news. I was the late night news guy for a very, very small ABC affiliate in the Midwestern United States. And what I did sometimes just to practice is I'd speak at civic clubs and organizations at their meetings. Mm-hmm. And do sort of a, you know, 20 to 30 minute talk on the television business and the inside scoop and so forth. And it was just, for me, it was a way to kind of practice, which I just felt I should kind of do. So, and I kind of took to it. You know, it was something that I felt was a strength, innate strength. Yet I certainly wasn't very good at it at first. And it was something I had to do a lot more of and continue to learn.
I think that's fairly typical. I mean, even people who have that natural talent to present in public, I think you start and you may have a natural talent and be good at it, but I think with time, you just get better at it if you choose to continue to learn and grow, which of course is a choice. So do you remember one of your early ones and walking away and thinking, oh yes, I have to do more of that? Do you remember one of those?
I'm not sure if I necessarily remember it back when I was just doing them to do them to get good at it, but I do recall as I started to speak, and I wasn't really speaking professionally at this point. This is after I graduated into sales, and I had worked my way up to sales manager of another company, and I had attended a seminar where they were selling cassette. This is how long ago this was. cassette tape albums, right? You know, and I bought one of the speaker's albums, and at the end of it, it said something like, "If you'd like to become a professional speaker, I didn't say professional speaker. If you'd like to become a speaker representing this course and making extra money or something, whatever it was, call us at, you know, whatever." So I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. I'd like to know what that's about. So, so I called them. What it was they would teach you how to give those 20 to 30 minute talks at every civic group, club, organization, any group that would, have you in to speak for free. And at the end, you'd sell their tapes. You'd sell the speaker's tapes, and they trained you how, right? And so I think at one point I was their nationally their, you know, best salesperson.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure how many there were, but they.
Right. That's so cool.
Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. And then eventually, though, I wanted to kind of do my own thing. And I thought, you know, I could be a speaker. I could do this. But I wanted to speak on my own materials that I had sort of been developing. And as I had grown in sales. Right. So I broke off on my own and then learned how to set up a speaking business, which, you know, like anything else, it's a business. There's a way to do it. And as they said on they used to say on the Seinfeld show, yada, 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 30 years later, here we are talking to each other.
Yada, yada, yada. I have some yada, yada, yadas in my past. So I hear you.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't?
Well, the reason I'm asking is that and maybe it's because I haven't been doing it as long as you have, but I have this vivid memory of my first big keynote where there were 500 people in the audience and I told a couple stories and then I talked about what storytelling is all about and some key takeaways, you know, the practicality of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I remember stepping off the stage, and when everything was over for that particular session, I had at least a dozen people come and talk to me, and I had to go to the bathroom because I was so nervous that morning. I had way too much coffee, and I'm literally
that's a lesson you learned early on, right?
Yeah, the very first big one. I was like, oh, okay, so the coffee thing has to stop at a certain time. Exactly. Yes, exactly. And that's why this is so vivid, I'm sure. And I had to kind of excuse myself, but I didn't want to because I was so honored. I always know when a presentation went well, when people want to talk to me afterward and they're enthralled and they are engaged. So I remember walking through the auditorium to get to the bathroom, and at least three people asked me if my book was for sale at the conference. And I remember thinking, oh, damn, now I have to write a book. So I just have this really vivid memory. And I also vividly remember talking to my husband. Oh my gosh. And his husband, his name is Bob. And I said, my God, Bob, this was so amazing. I have to do more of this. This just, I was so energized by it. So I'm curious if you have a memory like that early in your career where you realized I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing.
It's not so much that it's that, there wasn't anything that dramatic, but what was, and it's a story I tell, to people often, especially salespeople, when they really don't understand the importance of focusing on others, of taking your focus off yourself and making it not about you, but making it about others, which sounds nicey nice to some of them, but not practical. And I tell the story. I'd been in sales for a couple of years, and I'd doing fairly well. But I went to work for another company, and they were selling a high ticket item, and I wasn't doing very well at first. In fact, I started out in a slump, and I was having trouble getting out of that slump. And the bigger the slump, the longer I was in that slump, the more I was focused on myself and making the sale. And it was all about me, which of course is the very opposite of what we need to do if we're going to be successful in selling. And there was a gentleman who worked at the company that I was working for. He was not in the sales department. I think he was in the engineering department, and that he retired soon after. He was an older guy, and I didn't know him very well, and he didn't say a whole lot, but he was one of these people that I think we've all met, this type that, didn't say a lot, but whenever he did, it was always profound.
Right. A zinger.
Exactly. And so I think he saw me as someone like Joe in the Go Giver that I would write about 25 years later with John David Mann, as that young, ambitious, aggressive, up and coming, hardworking, but very frustrated salesperson who wasn't, coming near to reaching his potential.
Right.
And he said to me, Berg, he was a last name kind of guy. And he said, Berg, can I give you some advice? And I said, yeah, please do. I need it. And he said, if you want to make a lot of money in sales, he said, don't have making money as your target. Your target is serving others. Now, when you hit the target, you'll get a reward, and that reward will come in the form of money. And you can do with that money whatever you choose. But never forget, he said, the money is simply the reward for hitting the target. It ain't the target itself. Your target is serving others. And that was really my epiphany, because it was the first time I truly recognized and embraced at a heart level that great salesmanship is never about the salesperson. Great salesmanship is never about the product or service, as important as those are. Great salesmanship is about the other person. It's about those people whose lives you choose to serve. It's and add value to. It's about that person or those people whose lives are better just by you being part of it. That's selling. And it's the same when you're on stage. It's never about the speaker. A great speech is never about the speaker. It's not about the topic, as important as that is.
Right.
A great speech is about those audience members you're wanting to add value to, about those audience members whose life is a little bit better afterwards, just by having been there to see you speak.
Yes. I'm trying to form some words here. I was thinking about Kimberly Davis, because she wrote Brave Leadership. I believe
I love her. She's fantastic. One of my favorite books and favorite people.
Yes. She's one of my dear friends. And, we were talking about public speaking and the nerves ahead of time, And she was telling me her story. I interviewed her for this podcast as well. And she was telling me her story of her TED talk and how nervous she was. And the reality that, and she may have even mentioned you and the Go-Giver at that point, I don't remember, but she said, I had to take the focus off of me. It had to be about what do I want the audience to take from this? Mm-hmm. What impact do I want to have? And that's her statement. What impact do I want to have? And so hearing you say it with such passion and care just really, it really resonates with me. It always has, but now hearing it again, you can't hear that too much. I think across the board. And I love this idea that the target isn't the money. The target is serving the person. And once you serve them, the money is what is the reward for that. I love that perspective.
Well, it's why John David Mann and I say in one of the books in the series, we say that money is simply an echo of value. That's really what it is. Money is an echo of value. It's the thunder, if you will, to value's lightning, which really means nothing more than that the focus must be on the value you're providing another human being. The money you receive is a natural result of that value.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the last part of Joe's story in The Go-Giver, because I think oftentimes we kind of close up our idea about what we want. So we see the opportunity that actually lands in our lap if we can just open our eyes. Mm-hmm. Has that happened to you where you had that experience?
Yeah, well, you know, we talk about the fifth law, and that's the one we were talking about with Joe, the law of receptivity. That the key to effective giving is to stay open to receiving, right?
Exactly.
And that means really nothing more than an understanding that you breathe out, but you also have to breathe in if you're going to survive, if you're going to thrive, right? Mm-hmm. Never mind survive. And, you know, you breathe out carbon dioxide, you breathe in oxygen, you breathe out, which is giving, you breathe in, which is receiving. Giving and receiving, despite the messages we receive from the world around us everywhere about lack, about, when it comes to prosperity, when it comes to abundance, when it comes to money, when it comes to business, you know, people just paint it as such a horrible, evil thing. And I don't know why, other than I guess it's human nature, but that gets into people's heads on a very unconscious level because it's a message we hear and see all the time. So, you know, we like to say that despite these messages, giving and receiving are not opposite concepts. They're simply two sides of the very same coin, like breathing out and breathing in. They work in tandem. It's not, are you a giver or a receiver? You're a giver and a receiver.
Right.
But what you know is that the laws of life say that the giving comes first. We plant before we harvest, right? We sow before we reap. We give value to others before we receive. But when we do that, we need to then be open to receiving. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is, you know, it's one thing to say it, it's another to do it. And I remember soon after the book came out, my bookkeeper at the time, Trina, very wonderful person, she was over here doing some book work. And I noticed she had this really, really neat pen. And I said, wow, that is a really cool, I mean, it wasn't fancy. It was just a nice, cool pen, a cool looking pen. So that's a really cool pen. And I said, I'm going to get one of those. And she goes, oh, and she turned around. She said, oh, here, have this one. I've got plenty of them. And I said, oh, no, I can't take your pen. She goes, no, really, here, take it. I'm giving it to you. I said, nah, that's okay. I don't. She goes, why won't you take my pen? I said, I wouldn't feel right. And she says, now remember, I had just written a book, right? Co-authored a book where receptivity is one of the laws. She said, Bob, let me make a suggestion to you. Two things. One, take the pen. Two, say thank you. And I thought, oh, wow. I just, you know, was not paying attention to my own book.
That is exactly right. That's exactly the story I was looking for, Bob. Thank you. But I hear you. I think it's hard sometimes to accept help, to accept gifts, especially if you, because reciprocity isn't direct all the time. It's not you give me something and then I give you something back. It's maybe you give something to me and then I pass it along to somebody else. Because it's not necessarily a direct reciprocity, I think sometimes it's hard to receive if we don't feel like we've given. And as an example of that, when my husband broke his leg many years ago, And it was really stressful in our house. We had two little boys and two dogs and a house built in 1890. And I remember just kind of hitting my wit's end. And I was really kind of stressed. Well, not kind of stressed. I was extremely stressed. And I remember I was just about to talk to my husband, and I don't think it would have come out very well. He's in his recliner with his leg up. I'm stressed. And I remember seeing one of our neighbors walking through our yard mowing our lawn. Now, I hadn't asked anyone for help. I heard the noise, and then I saw him walking by our windows with his lawnmower, and I literally started to cry. And I'm not a crier. I'm not a particularly emotional or sensitive person, but man, that sense of receiving without having to ask was just huge for me. And it was really that experience that made me more receptive to accepting assistance, to accepting help.
What a great story. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I love that kind of story. So do you have any stories about the pivotal moments before writing that book? You know, something I loved how you described how it was written, that you guys just, you don't even remember who had the idea about a lot of this stuff because it went so organically between you and your co-author. So I'm curious if there was something like right before you started writing it that triggered kind of this thought, I have to write this book.
Well, years ago, I had a book. It was really my first big book. It was called Endless Referrals. The subtitle was Network Your Everyday Contacts into Sales. And it was really a how-to book for entrepreneurs and salespeople who knew they had a great product or service. They knew it brought exceptional value to others. But they weren't necessarily comfortable going out into their local communities and building the kind of relationships that would result in people wanting to do business with them directly and refer them to others. So, yeah. So I wrote Endless Referrals as a traditional how-to step-by-step system. I define a system as the process of predictably achieving a goal based on a logical and specific set of how-to principles, the key being predictability. If it's been proven that by doing A, you'll get desired result of B, then you know all you need to do is A and continue to do A and continue to do A, and eventually you'll get the desired result of B. That's what Endless Referrals was about, okay? But it was a how-to book. And I love how-to books. I read lots of how-to books, but I also had, you know, throughout the years or from the moment I got involved in sales, also had read parables. And I always loved reading parables because I think, you know, as you would know, you're an expert on this, stories connect on a whole different level, right? A much deeper level. And I knew that the parables I had read, I felt a connection with the author, with the characters. It was easier to receive and understand the message. And I thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could take the basic premise of Endless Referrals, which was that all things being equal, people will do business with and refer business to those people they know, like, and trust, and turn that into a parable. So in coming up with the name, it was pretty easy because I just asked myself, so what is the essence of that kind of person who is able to quickly and sustainably cultivate these know, like, and trust relationships? And the answer is, well, they're givers. They're always looking to give to others. They're looking to give value to everyone they meet. And so coming up with the title, The Go-Giver, that was pretty easy. But the best thing that I did for this book was to ask John David Mann to be the co-author and lead storyteller. And when I say asked him to, I mean pleaded with him to, because I knew, John, you know, I'm a how-to guy. I'm step one, step two, step three. Right. John is a magnificent writer. And I knew him at the time. I'd never met him personally, but I knew him because he was the editor-in-chief of a magazine I used to write for. Mm-hmm. And every month I'd submit my articles and you know, you've worked with editors before. You know, they're great, they're knowledgeable, but sometimes they just leave your best stuff on the cutting room floor. They just make cuts without asking and take something out of context. And John wasn't like that. John was always polite and kind, and you know, he'd send it back, let me know, you know, I did this, I put this here, I took this out, is it okay? And he always ended it with, is it okay? And every month I'd write him back the same thing saying, John, not only is it okay, you write my stuff better than I write my stuff. And you know, and back then, John wasn't very well known. He was known within a certain niche as being brilliant. Now, you know, after The Go-Giver came out, he became sort of the golden boy of publishers and agents. So when they have a celebrity or an athlete or a business icon or somebody who they want to have write a book, John's the ghostwriter or the co-author. Okay. And so he's got numerous best-selling books out there. But back then, very few people knew of this guy's brilliance. Fortunately, I was one of them who did. And so he was still very busy at the time, though, and didn't know if he wanted to do it. But, you know, later he told me, he said to his then fiance, now wife, Anna, he said to her, you know, I really don't have time to do another project, do another book. But, you know, it's Bob. How am I supposed to just say no without at least six? And that's where the relationship comes in, right? The no, like, and trust relationship. So he and Anna, who live in Western Massachusetts, they were down visiting her mom on the Gulf side of the Gulf Coast of Florida. And they took a 4-hour drive over one night. We had a 3-hour dinner to discuss the book and see what we thought about, where it would go, how it would be written, what we wanted to do with it, the whole thing. He still wasn't totally persuaded, but about 3 weeks later, he called me and he said, you know, I think we've got something here. So we actually wrote the book in maybe 2 or 3 months. But then we went through a year of, I think, 25 rejections, you know, through our agent. She shopped the book around, 25 rejections from New York publishing houses. And finally, we came across the perfect publishing partner, which was Portfolio, a business book division of Penguin Random House. And they have just been absolutely wonderful and fantastic. So, you know, what happened was exactly what was supposed to happen when it was supposed to happen.
I am a big believer in that. Absolutely. And what I love about that story is the synchronicity, the thoughtfulness of meeting face to face to have this discussion. Mm-hmm. And I loved the thank yous, the acknowledgments in your book. I have to say, being somebody who believes so strongly in gratitude as a form of finding joy, reading those, I don't always read the acknowledgments in books. I have to admit, sometimes I don't even read the foreword. If I want to just get in and read it, I'll just do it. But your acknowledgments drew me in because one of my good friends, Melissa Hughes, who's also friends with Kimberly, it's all connected, wrote a book called Happy Hour with Einstein. And the first part is all about what we've learned about Einstein's brain as a result of finally getting to study it. Mm-hmm. And the second half is really, or the other 2/3 of the book is about how gratitude affects the brain. And then solid strategies on how to use that, how to apply that knowledge. So reading your gratitude in that book really spoke to me. It really resonated. So thank you for making that such an important part of your book.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I know we need to come full circle here, and I would love to hear one more story from you, if that's okay. I love the pen story because it definitely describes that whole being open and receptive to the gift. So do you have another story that's similar to that where you had to learn your own lesson? I have a lot of those. I have to practice what I preach and I forget.
Well, I mean, I think life is, you know, a continuing journey on learning. Yeah.
You hope so.
Yeah, some of them we hope we don't have to overlearn and keep learning, and others, you know, others we do. But yeah, I think I could go through, you know, a lot of those. I think some of the best stories, though, were the ones that we heard from people after the book came out. You know, one thing that was surprising to us was that the early adopters of the book were not the ones that needed it at all. These were the people who had always been living their lives and conducting their business that way and were already very successful. And they would email John or they'd email me and they'd say something like, this is exactly how I built my business. So these are the exact things I did. And you know, these were really very, very successful people. And they'd say, but the people who work for me or the people in my organization, they don't believe me. Because remember, people have been brought up to believe it's this, you know, that the people who make it are the ones who are ruthless and horrible and evil. And, you know, and of course, it's a big world. There's lots of people out there who do bad things and so forth. Right. But remember, those are the ones that get the coverage. Those are the ones that get you know, the media.
The ones you hear about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what they were doing is they would, you know, they would buy the books for others. And I mean, we had very large orders, you know, from different companies and organizations. And because they wanted, they used us as third party credibility. You know, they were humble enough leaders to know that, you know, they might not be believed themselves, right? Because you know how that is when you're too close to someone, they might love you, but they don't necessarily, you don't have the same credibility. So they used our book as third party credibility. So that those were the early adopters. The second wave, if you will, were the ones who needed it. And told us great stories about how they, you know, their business just turned around once they, and that the five laws kind of gave them permission to do business the way they wanted. Because remember, you know, most people, the majority of people are good people. They're well-intended people. I think as human beings, we're built to desire to be part of something bigger than ourselves. We want to add value to the world. We want to be of value to those around us. And in business, we express that through our work.
Right.
And so, you know, so most people want to really make a difference, and they also want to make a very nice income, which they should. And so what the book did is basically said, yes, you know, it's not a matter of making a great income despite being good to others. It's making a great income because you're good to others, and you're right. And people wanted to hear that. They wanted to know that, and they wanted to know how to do it.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because it's not what I would have expected, but it doesn't surprise me. It's similar to when you responded that you would absolutely, I'd love to be on your podcast. It wasn't something that I thought about, but it didn't surprise me when I saw the results. So hearing that actually doesn't surprise me. And here's why. You know, you've read books that you didn't necessarily need to read, but you read them because it felt good to have confirmation that you were on the right track. And that's what these people did. They read it. I did that with some of the Raising Your Kids books. Like I didn't read books about raising children. I just kind of went with it. And I, you know, just like any other parent, I messed up here and there. But I remember every once in a while when I worked at the library, I'd pick up a book about your six-year-old because I had a six-year-old and I would read through parts of it. And there was so much comfort in the confirmation that certain things that I was already doing that they were recommending. So
yeah, that's neat.
And when you're raising kids, that's a big deal, of course, the confirmation, but it's also confirmation for a leader who's been successful using those tools. And you're right. My friend calls it, well, you can't be a prophet in your own town. That's, I think that's a biblical comment, but, and I'm not religious, but I think it came from somewhere in the Bible, but you can't be a prophet in your own town. So people don't always listen to you if you know them or if they know you really well.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense to me. And thank you for sharing that because I think other listeners that might not think they need to read it because they're already go givers, they already give. It's a different way of giving. For me, it was more a structure to it, which I've never had a structure to my giving. And having that kind of laid out with the five principles really helped me kind of wrap my head around why I'm doing what I'm doing and how I could do it better. And this early in the conversation, when you talked about money not being the target, but money being the reward, that, you know, I'm a parent. I see that all the time. And not just money being a reward, but whatever reward you receive from it isn't about the reward in the first place. So thank you for sharing that. Bob, this has been such a pleasure. And I so appreciate that you are practicing what you preach, your thoughtful and generous attitude about helping others. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure and honor.
Are you ready to start your story portfolio so you have the right story ready to share when the opportunity presents itself? When you're ready to get started, my book, Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will, is available in all the regular places, and the audiobook version is available on Google Play and on my website, elkinsconsulting.com. As a special bonus for listeners, the audiobook includes two songs recorded by my band, Spare Change, in my living room in Montana. Also on my website is a free podcast interview checklist. It's available to download to make sure you make the most out of your next podcast interview. If you enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to rate the podcast and leave a review and let me know that you've done it so I can thank you properly. Thank you.